some of the youth should probably be able to memorize this passage of Scripture now, as we've read it every week for probably 3 or 4 weeks now. But there's a lot in here, and there's a lot. The Bible's just a deep book. I mean, there is just things that it goes way beyond just the normal reading and the normal, just on the surface of what it says, and we need to know what it says, and we need to understand that. But when we try to put the pieces of the puzzle together, we realize that there's no way man wrote this book. There is absolutely no way. With 39 authors across, 2 or 3 continents, 1,500 years apart, and they all agree. And they all fit together in such a supernatural way that it's just amazing. And, you know, every time we study and I ask God to show me something, and I'm still surprised when He does it, because just the way that He brings it across and the way that He enlightens our mind with the Word of God. And so, starting in verse 3 of 2 Peter chapter 1, it says, "According as His divine power hath given us all things that pertain unto life and godliness, through the knowledge of Him that hath called us to glory and virtue." Okay, that is what we are called to do. As Christians, we are called to glory and virtue, "whereby are given unto us exceeding great and precious promises, that by these ye might be partakers of the divine nature." Okay, "having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust." And that's our goal. That should be our end goal as a Christian, is that we are partakers of the divine nature. All right, we will have that someday. We will have a divine nature, a new body, someday down the line when God calls us home, or the rapture or death or whatever it may be, we'll have a new nature as far as a new body. But we have right now a new nature that's been placed inside of us when God put the new man, when God got rid of the old man, put the new man in. And so we have a divine nature inside of us that is our choice to partake of it or not. When we go through life, we have the choice to either follow the old man or follow the new man. And when we follow the new man, when we follow what God would have us to do, then we partake of the divine nature that God has put inside of us. And that's our job. And it says, that is, "and having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust." Obviously, when we follow the divine nature, when we follow the new man, we escape the corruption that is in this world. And then starting in verse 5, it says, "And beside this, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue." The first thing after upon salvation, the first thing of having that faith placed inside of us and believing God and having salvation, is that we are supposed to have virtue. And I preached on it just a couple weeks ago, I believe, whenever that was, about virtue and how we are supposed to live our lives not for ourselves. No Christian in this life is ever supposed to live and die and just get himself gain. He is supposed to live for other people. We are supposed to bear one another's burdens. That's the responsibility that we have, is to live for others. Okay, and so that's first. The first off is virtue. And then to virtue, knowledge. Okay, and then to knowledge, temperance. And to temperance, patience. And to patience, godliness. And to godliness, brotherly kindness. And to brotherly kindness, charity. For if these things be in you and abound, they make you that ye shall neither be unbarren, or they neither be barren nor unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. And so this whole thing that I've been going through probably the last 3 or 4 weeks in Sunday school class, and it really stretches even beyond back to where I started talking about wheat. And I think I had a lesson or two here in Sunday school class about wheat and how God uses the parallel of wheat, of growing that plant, and uses that to teach us how that we're supposed to grow up and to go through the process to get ready to be used for somebody else, to be turned into a nice flour that we can then make the cinnamon roll, right? We want to be cinnamon rolls. Okay, nobody wants a flat biscuit. Okay, nobody wants, you know, a whole wheat loaf of bread that didn't get enough water and now it can use it as a doorstop. Okay? That's honestly, that's a lot of times what Christians are. All right? We could be 100% whole wheat, the best value nutrition that you can get for bread, and we're a brick that holds a door open. Why? Because things weren't put into the process in a right way. We didn't follow certain leadings in a right way. And when it comes out of the oven, you just know that is not going to be good. Okay? Now, on the other hand, when everything works right and you have about 3 sticks of butter and a cup of sugar and cinnamon and everything else, you pops out of the oven a cinnamon roll that you cover in cream cheese icing, and that is a great benefit to somebody else. Okay? And that's what our goal is in our Christian life, is to be a cinnamon roll. Or, if you were here for the play, to be one of those oatmeal cream pies. Or for the program. Yeah, one of those things. All right? That's what you're supposed to be. Hint, hint, Mrs. Key. All right? Oatmeal cream pies are one of those like cupcakes with the Reese's pieces that were on. Anyway, all right, but that's our goal as Christians. We should be. Is there anybody in your life that would look at you and say, you know what? They're just an oatmeal cream pie. I enjoy them. I mean, we all have the people in our lives that it's like, oh, they're a brick of a loaf of bread. But is there anybody in your life that you have affected or that you've come into contact with that would say, I truly enjoy that person? When I walk away from that person, I feel fed. When you have somebody over, when you have fellowship with other believers, and it's the right kind of fellowship, and it's centered around the Lord, and you have good conversation, and you have a good time, you have good, clean fun, you walk away from that kind of just like, yeah, feeling good. Right? You come to church and you hear the song sang and you get a good message and it hits you and you get filled up and then you walk away just kind of like after a good meal. Is there anybody in your life that would say, that person is that for me? You know what? Is there somebody in your life that says, hey, they're a cinnamon roll that I just enjoy being around? All right, so that's the goal. That's the goal, is that we're fruitful. And the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, meekness, faith, good temperance, all those sort of things. You know, those are almost all of those are meant for other people. And I can't stress it enough that our lives are not our own. Teens, youth, your lives are not your own. I remember how many people I heard growing up in high school and after that. I'm just going to get out and do what I want to do. I'm just going to get out and just live my life. Right? I'm going to live my life. I want to do what I want to do. And the people that really got to do what they want to do right now that were my age in high school are miserable wrecks. Miserable wrecks. All right? And so the point that I want to get across so much is that when you start having faith and you believe the Word of God, the next step is to live your life for other people. Now, when talking about going back to wheat, you get through that whole process. But wheat in itself, once it's ground into a flour, I mean, it can be the nice, you know, $5-6 a pound of King Arthur bread flour that would, you know, make the best loaf of bread that you can get. But in reality, you don't just take a spoon and eat that. It really doesn't taste good. You know, Ian would do that all the time. You go in and you're making biscuits or you're making, you know, something along, and he comes in and everything's cookie dough, right? You know, Mom makes cookie dough and we all get spoons and we eat it, right? So any other time I make something, it's cookie dough, lick it, and he'll go in and he'll take it. It has to have things added to it to really taste good, okay? And that's what 2 Peter chapter 1 is talking about. It says, besides all this, giving all diligence, add to your faith, and then it lists out this long thing. Okay? And the first one of those is virtue, the substance of what you are. That's the flour, that's the salt, that's the water, that's all those things that are just the base ingredients that go into a loaf of bread. It's for the benefit of others, it's for the nourishment of others, it's to strengthen someone else. So then we add in knowledge. The next one, virtue, faith, virtue, knowledge. Okay? And so in a worldly sense, we are pushed for knowledge. Kids these days, even back in my day, whenever it is, you got to go to school, you got to get an education, you have to go to a 4-year college, you have to do this, you have to do that, and then you'll walk out knowing something. No. All right? It doesn't work that way. Okay? But that's what we're pushed for. Right? We're always pushed to learn, to know more. And learning and knowing more is a good thing. But, you know what? When it comes to spiritual things, it tends to get backed off. We just go to church, we just show up, and then we leave, and we've done our due diligence, right? Why is that not push for knowledge transferred over into the spiritual realm? Okay? There is a famous saying that says, some people drink from the fountain of knowledge and some people just gargle. And I fear a lot of times when we come into a church and we sit down and we hear the preaching and we say, you know what? Hey, that was a good message. And then we walk off, never being the better or changing for it. It was like we had, you know, the coldest, you know, Coke from McDonald's. And we took a big drink, and then we went, and then just spit it out. And be like, that was good Coke. It's probably the best way you should drink it. But what did it do? Nothing. I mean, you got a little buzz, you know, fizzy bubbles in your mouth and whatnot. But that's about it. And a lot of times, I think that's how we view church. That's how we view the Bible. We read our Bible in the morning. Spit it out. That was good. I read it. It's done. But it didn't go down inside of you and affect something in your life. Okay? And it's knowledge that has to do that in our lives. Okay? So, knowledge is power. Anybody ever heard that before? Knowledge is power. If we can just educate everyone, then everything will get better. And for the most part, yeah, you're right. Give a man a fish and he's fed for a day. Teach a man how to fish and he's fed for a lifetime, right? All those sort of things. Knowledge is power. All right, so when you're talking about bread, I'm going to make a lot of illustrations to making bread through this Sunday school class. When you're talking about bread, you have the virtue, which is the substance, the flour, the salt, the water, all those things that are nutritious for somebody else. But then you need something to just give it a little oomph, right? Otherwise, you mix some flour, salt, and water together, and you form it all up, and then you spread it out on a pan, and you bake it in the oven, and it doesn't change. It just gets harder. Okay? But you add in a little bit of yeast, and you put it in there, and you mix it, and you knead it a little bit, and then you let it sit. And what happens to it? It starts to rise. There's a chemical reaction that creates alcohol and everything else inside of it, and it blows it up, right? It blows it up and makes it nice and fluffy and soft so you can slather it in butter and, you know, eat a, you know, a nice dinner roll, whatever it may be. All right, so that's the knowledge. That's knowledge, okay? Yeast is knowledge. You know what happens when you put too much yeast in something? It goes, and then it just implodes on itself. You let something proof for too long, you let knowledge, or you let yeast proof for too long, it goes bigger, 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 and then all of a sudden it's like, and it's done, and it's flat, and it's a doorstop. Okay? But that's what knowledge is. And so it's kind of like this. I'm going to make two illustrations through this whole thing, one about making bread and one about a car. Knowledge is the 454 Hemi supercharged, bored over, you know, in the front of a cherry red Camaro with the white racing stripe down the top. Okay? I mean, it is the power that gets that thing going. I mean, it'll do 0 to 60 before you can blink and burn rubber the whole way. All right? That's knowledge. Knowledge is power. Knowledge is horsepower. Knowledge is the thing that just makes it go. But we have a problem. Knowledge without temperance is a wreck waiting to happen. And I talked about temperance last week in the Sunday school class, but the kind of Lord showed me more about it this week, so we're going to stay there. And is that temperance is the steering wheel. Temperance is the brakes. What good is a supercharged 454 Hemi in a car without brakes? Has anybody ever been in a car, like actually driving down the road when the brakes went out? That's scary. You're driving along expecting everything to work like it's supposed to work. A car's come, or if you're, maybe not the brakes went out, but on a sheet of ice. And you're driving along, everything seems fine, and all of a sudden you put your foot on the brake and there's no resistance. And you're sitting there and you're just pumping the thing, trying to get it to stop, and it's not stopping. That's scary. That is scary, realizing that you have no control whatsoever of the vehicle that you're riding in. And that's temperance. Temperance is our brakes. Temperance is our steering wheel. Temperance is how we control the power, how we control the knowledge that God has given us in our life. Okay, so what good is all the power without the braking? Now, everybody likes power. Nobody wants to drive, you know, a little Yugo. Okay? Nobody wants to drive a little Datsun. I remember anybody remember the car Datsun? My mom and dad had one, little hatchback, you know. I think the thing went 55 on a good day. You know, I mean, it was just a small little thing. All right, it's like this. For those of you guys, you kids don't know what a Datsun are. You go, it's like riding a moped or riding a Harley. All right? What's the difference? More power. All right? And so we need more power, but we have to be able to control it. We have to be able to temper it. All right, and so there's two aspects of temperance. There's two aspects. One is the restraint. Okay, that's the brakes. That's the brakes on a vehicle, is restraint, is moderation, is abstinence, is self-control. Okay? And I've told the teens time and time again, Brother Precock tells them at camp, everything that goes on is that you personally have to put safeguards in your life so, one, things don't get in, and two, you don't get out. You have to make those changes in your life that stop you from going places you shouldn't go. If you know you have a bent towards whatever it may be, then put things into your life that stop those chances of that happening. Okay? That's temperance. That is you putting things into your life so that you deal in moderation, you deal in self-control. But let me put the illustration this way. There's two aspects of temperance. One is that you surround something and you control it that way. But let me ask you this. Bumper cars are controlled. They're in a set area. They're not going to get out of that area. But what happens in a bumper car? It's just chaos. They're just bouncing off of walls and just back and forth. You know, it's like throwing a bouncy ball in a small room and it just starts, you know, going everywhere. It's within the confines of the room, right? It's within the confines of the controls that are being placed, but it is out of control. Okay, and so that's the other aspect of temperance is, yes, you have to put outside controls on your life so that you don't go places you shouldn't go and do things you shouldn't do. But after that, you have to move past the state of just being confined or just being restrained about being tempted. Has anybody ever heard of hypermiling? Okay, it's a way that you would drive your car so that you reach the most effective miles per gallon that you can. Okay? Has anybody been with the driver that it's either all or nothing? It's and then right? I mean, they go through brake pads three times as fast as anybody else. All right? I'm like that. Okay? I'm going to have to change my brake pads like crazy on the truck this year with the trailer because it's just and back and forth. But there's this thing called hypermiling, which is where, amongst other things, you try to drive with the absolute minimal use of your brakes. The absolute minimal use of your brakes. You think, how do you do that? It takes you looking ahead far, far down the road and realizing, hey, a mile down the road, there's a stop sign. So I should probably let off the gas a little bit here and coast for a while. And then once you get up closer to the stop sign, then you know you just kind of tap the brakes a little bit just to stop, and then it's slow acceleration again. And from what I've read, and it's really hard to put into practice, but you know, you could increase 30, 40, 50%, whatever it may be. I know we had a friend of ours that he was on this kick for a while, and he already had a little Hyundai, I think, Accent or something like that, one of them little tin cans that, you know, he was driving around. They already get like 35 miles a gallon. But I think he was up to like 60 or 65 miles a gallon in this little car because he adjusted the way that he drove. And you realize that every time you have to push on the brakes hard, you realize that that meant you were going too fast for the conditions, so you were using gas that you really didn't need to use. Just think about that. Every time you push on the brakes, you're just throwing dollars out the window from the gas that you used, right? But that's what I'm talking about. Temperance is the idea that you don't live your life back and forth, pinball back and forth, bumper car all over, staying within the confines, but still out of control. Temperance says, hey, I'm going to look down the road and, oh, the car ahead of the car that I'm following just put on their brakes, so I need to back off a little bit. You know what? I can see something up the road, so let me just, you know, make sure there's enough room, enough cushion between me and the next car. Okay? You shouldn't be able to tell, like, what color the person's eyes are, you know, that's in the car in front of you. Right? You're supposed to have some cushion or space there. And so that's the idea, the difference between temperance, the two aspects of temperance. And so we reduce the need for outside controls by having our own actions in moderation. It's the difference between control and self-control. Okay? Control is when your parents say, hey, you have to be home by 9:30. Self-control is you saying, well, I should probably be home by 9:15 then. What is that doing? That is you putting own restrictions on yourself, learning to govern yourself and govern your own actions to be temperate. Okay? To be temperate. To have temperance. Now, we need to be tempered in our lives. The only way to do that is to be tempered. Now look at two places. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And Exodus chapter 30. Get both of those. So there's two aspects of temperance. One is this idea of self-control, restraint, moderation, abstinence. Okay, that is one aspect of temperance, to be tempered. Now, the other side of it is to be tempered. That doesn't mean you have a temper. It means that you are tempered. Anybody ever heard of tempered steel? Okay. So, what is tempered steel? Somebody give me the dictionary definition. Anybody? Tempered steel. All right, it's steel that has been put through a process, typically heating. So what happens is steel is it goes through the refining process and then gets rolled out, and it's super hot, right? And so then they plunge it into a water to cool it rapidly, which makes it hard, okay, which makes it brittle. But now we have a problem because even though it's hard, it's very brittle. Okay, I had a tungsten carbide wedding ring. I loved it. It was smooth as can be. It was a little bit heavy. But tungsten carbide is one of the harder metals that's as far as known. Okay, and so I literally took a bolt out of a car that I was working on and sat there and ground on it, and it never left a scratch. Never left a scratch on the ring. Okay? But I'm over at the Montels, and why we were playing basketball at 9:30 at night when it was like 25 degrees outside, I'll never know. But I'm out there with the kids, and we're playing basketball. And, of course, the rim is set at like 8 feet, right? So I can dunk on it, because that's the only way I'm ever going to dunk is when the rim is 8 feet. And so we're playing basketball. We're playing around. We're shooting around. And I go up with the ball in my left hand, and I slam it down on the rim like I am in the NBA, right? Pretty sure I jumped over Josh. Like, I was feeling really good, okay? And what happens? My ring hits that rim. It's cold. The rim's cold. Everything's cold, and it shatters. I only found a quarter of that ring. The rest is in the Montel's grass somewhere, just waiting for the lawnmower to pick it up and shoot it into somebody's window. All right? But even though it was super hard and you couldn't scratch it, it's very brittle. And when it becomes cold and it gets hit really hard, it would crack and it would shatter. Now, tempering puts it through a process of slowly heating it to a certain temperature and then bringing it back down at a certain rate so that the metal, even though it now is still hard, it becomes a little bit more malleable, meaning that it can be worked a little bit more. Okay? Springs, for example, are still steel, but they have been tempered so much that now they're elastic. Okay? Now, when you punch them or shatter them or hit them with a hammer, they're not going to shatter, they're going to dent. They're going to give a little bit. Okay? That's tempering. But the reason that it does that is because now the steel, all the parts of the steel have become meshed together. You realize when there's a break, where does the break happen? In the weakest point, right? So the break, if you ever have a rope that breaks or something metal that breaks, it happens at the weakest point. All right, so that's tempering. Tempering is where we take the things in our life and we uniformly put them all together so that it's a stronger and better substance. Okay, first let's look at the Bible to get this definition. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. 1 Corinthians 12, 24. This is talking about the body of Jesus Christ. It's talking about the church. All right, it says, "For our comely parts have no need, but God hath tempered the body together, having given more abundant honor to that part which lacked." All right, Exodus chapter 30, verse 35. Exodus chapter 30, verse 35 or 34, it says, "And the Lord said unto Moses, Take unto these sweet spices, stacti on whatever these things are, these sweet spices with pure frankincense, of each shall be a like weight. And thou shalt make it a perfume, a confection after the art of the apothecary, tempered together, pure and holy." So what is this idea of tempering? To temper means to mix so that one part qualifies the other, to bring to a moderate state, such as to temper justice with mercy, to form by mixture, and to combine two or more things so as to reduce the excess of the qualities of either, and to bring the whole to the desired consistence or state, to unite in due proportion, and to render symmetrical, to adjust as parts to each other. Temperance, or to be tempered, means that in your life, you're not super strong and really good over here, and then super, super weak and low over here. Because what happens? You break at the weakest link. It does you no good to have a chain that's super thick, and then right in the middle, have a zip tie holding it together. Why? Because it'll break at the zip tie. Because that's the weakest link. And so in our lives, a lot of times what happens is we get saved and we kind of skip over the virtue part and then the knowledge goes up. And so now our knowledge is up here and our virtue is down here and we break. We're not tempered. We're not mixed uniformly. And that's normal for kids, or for teens, for youth. A child is naturally, excessive. Let's put it that way, right? We watched The Miracle Worker last night, about Helen Keller as she grew up, and Ann Sullivan, who taught her, she was blind and deaf, and she ended up teaching Helen Keller. She was the one blind and deaf, not Ann. And so we watched that, and in there it shows them doing all the sign language on her hand. And so Cole, he picks up on stuff really fast, and so we get done with the movie, and he comes over, and he starts doing all these hand motions. So Kirsten starts teaching him the letters for signs, and it's probably like a solid 10 or 15 minutes. He's just back and forth, just doing all these sort of things, right? He goes overboard on it, right? He just goes overboard on something. Kids naturally just go overboard, and so as adults, it's when we learn to, hey, I can't be loud right here because it would be socially awkward. Right? And so the kids, as they get a little older, they start realizing that, hey, they have to bring things down to be evil, to be even, to be equal. Okay, that's tempered. How do we get that? How do we get tempered in our Christian life? Now we have all of these illustrations about how do we get tempered how do we temper ourselves? And go back to 2 Peter chapter 1. It has to do with knowledge. We have to take the knowledge, we have to take the power, we have to take the strength and the fortitude that comes with knowledge, but it has to be applied. Besides all this, giving to your faith, or to your faith virtue, and to your virtue knowledge, and to knowledge temperance. We have to temper our knowledge that we have. It's temperance, if I could boil it down, is applied knowledge. Everybody knows someone that is just full of knowledge, and it really doesn't matter. The book smart guy that couldn't figure out how to get out the door. One of those type of people. No common sense, but could do advanced, somethingometry or whatever it may be, but couldn't figure out how to, flush the toilet. Who knows? All right? Knowledge is worthless without application. What's the one thing kids say in school all the time?
I'm never going to use this in life. Right? How does this even apply? Right?
And we tell them, it will someday. All right, it may not right now, but it will someday. And I'm getting to the point now where more and more in my life, I'm thinking, wow, that really did make sense. That really did. I should have listened then, because now I would be way better on my geometry if I would have listened. All right, whatever it may be, or English. That's always the hard part, English. Geometry I got pretty well. It was the English. So you know what? That's what we're talking about, applied knowledge. Knowledge is worthless without application. Okay, so let me go back to the illustration of a car. So how do we apply knowledge? How do we apply temperance if we were driving a car? It would be researching your route, knowing which way you're going to go, right? That's gaining the knowledge. Realizing that there's a stop sign at the intersection of this and this. When we temper ourselves, we realize, hey, I need to let off the gas here, so that I could coast to a stop there and not have to use the brakes. Where that's looking long term. Looking long term. That's how we apply knowledge in our lives. That's how we apply temperance. So to the bread, we balance the need for acceleration and braking. They're both needful. One is way more fun than the other, but they're both needful. But we have to balance them. Okay? And so go to the bread illustration. Knowledge is all of the ingredients in the bowl. It's the flour, it's the salt, it's the butter, it's the, you know, the yeast, or the yeast is the knowledge there. It's all of the things, the water, whatever it may be, maybe not yeast, maybe baking powder, whatever it is you're going to use to make that bread. That is all of the ingredients in the bread. That's right there. But to be tempered, you know what would happen if you just dumped all of the ingredients in the bread and then just dumped it out into a pan and then baked it? Nothing. That's what would happen. Nothing. But what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to temper that. And we start with a spoon and we start stirring. And then we add in a little water and we start stirring. You know, we mix our wet, we mix our dry, and then we mix them together, right? And then we add it from there. And then it comes to the point of kneading. And then we knead the bread. And what is kneading? Kneading is just making sure that everything is mixed completely and to develop the flour. To develop the knowledge, right? Wheat has gluten. That's what makes it so that it can stretch. When you have properly kneaded a loaf of bread, you could take a small piece of the dough and stretch it out, and it'll actually get paper thin to almost see through. But it'll all stay together. All right, that's part of that kneading process, part of the mixing process. All right, that's what your bread machine does, so you don't have to touch it. Okay, that's all tempering. It's all mixing it together, and it's a necessary, vital step. It has to be mixed and kneaded so that all of the ingredients are equally mixed and have come together uniformly. But most often, we just think about head knowledge. Knowledge puffeth up. We go to church, we hear something, and we can't wait to tell somebody else about it. And that's a good thing. We should be telling other people about it. But we can't skip over the idea that virtue tells that our life should be about others and not for someone else. And we need to fill up on knowledge. We need knowledge. But if we don't properly mix it into our lives and we don't apply it, we get a bunch of bloated Christians. And I'm afraid that's what a lot of the churches in the United States today, it's just fat, bloated Christians. Because we've been given the knowledge. But our lives, like in Revelation chapter 2 and 3, it says, I. And that knowledge doesn't get applied into your life to then get put out to somebody else. You ever seen a horse or a cow that hasn't necessarily been on a pasture for very much, and then you throw them out there on the pasture and they have all the grass they could eat? You know what happens to them? They look like they're pregnant. They get a big old fat grass belly, right? I mean, that thing is way out there, right? Just because of all the grass they've been eating. In your Christian life, we show up to church. We get the knowledge. We're supposed to. But don't get a grass belly. All right? Don't get spiritual indigestion. All right? When it just sits right there. Uncomfortable as can be. Right? Apply it to other people. Apply knowledge in your life. Thoroughly mix it. We're supposed to come to church and we get a smorgasbord of food. Sunday morning, Sunday night, Sunday school, all the things. We get a smorgasbord of spiritual food. And we have a lot of knowledge. If we've sat in this church and you've heard preaching for 5 or 8 or 10 years, as a Christian, as far as Bible knowledge-wise, you're driving around a 454 Hemi. I mean, you are driving the supercharged charger of spiritual knowledge. But use it wisely. Use it to pick somebody else up and take them somewhere really fast. All right? That's temperance. Not being too far out of balance. Not being, just leave it at that, not being unbalanced. And using that knowledge to go and help somebody else. All right, so we'll stop there. Lord, thank you for this time. Thank you for Sunday school. Please bless the church service, God. Pray you'd fill Pastor with your spirit, that you would be in the singing, and that you would just come in and be glorified today in our church service. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.